TheYeshiva.net.
Okay, today's class is dedicated by our dear friends, Liz and Dr. Michael Michelle. She's with us today in loving memory and tribute to the 24th Yahrzeit of Mrs. Michelle's father, Harav Yisrael Yitzchak Halevi ben Harav Binyamin, whose Yahrzeit is going to be this coming Shabbos, the 11th day of Tevis, 24th Yahrzeit. Rabbi Irving Levy, Rabbi Yisrael Yitzchak Halevi ben Harav Binyamin, is one of the founding fathers of the Muncie community back in 1952, and was one of the great activists and Balei Chesed and leaders and founders and a good friend of so many people here. And over the years has contributed immensely to the entire infrastructure of the Muncie community, the Torah and the Avodah and the Gemilas Chasadim. So today's class is dedicated in his memory. He was a respected Talmud Chacham, a legendary Baal Chesed, and one of the founders and the pillars of this incredible community. So thank you very much. And Tehei Nishmasei Tzura, B'Tzur HaChayim. I should also say that he has 6 grandchildren today who are serving as soldiers in Gaza in the army. So we want to bless them especially. Hashem Yishmer Tzeisam Ovoyam, Me'ata Va'ad Olam. May they and all of them return home safely. Amen. Also dedicated by Dina Dornbush for Refuah Shleima, complete and speedy recovery. For Rivka Bas Sheva Bas Pesi, may she be healthy and well and have a Refuah Kreiva, and thank you very much. It is also dedicated today's class for the 30th wedding anniversary of our dear friends, Rav Shleima and Blimi Kaller, for their 30th wedding anniversary. Mazel Tov, happy anniversary. May you enjoy many, many happy, healthy, beautiful, prosperous years with serenity, tranquility, nachas, expanse of consciousness, and all the blessings. Thank you. The book of Bereshis, the Sefer Bereshis in Chumash, certainly is filled with many, many very loaded, intense, and dramatic moments. But probably one can say that its most dramatic moment, or certainly one of the most dramatic moments in the whole Bereshis, and probably the whole of Tanakh, happens in the beginning of Parshas Vayigash, when Yosef reveals himself to his brothers after 22 years of separation, estrangement, and isolation. Every year when you read it again and again, you could start crying once again of how the Torah, which usually doesn't describe scenes in such an emotional way, but more tells you of the facts, and then you have to read the emotions between the lines. But here, goes out of its way to capture the emotions of Yehuda and Yosef and all of the brothers when he told them those 2 fateful words, Ani Yosef, I am Yosef, Ha'oid Avi Chai, is my father still alive? And the brothers can't even respond. They're simply overwhelmed. And it's a story, a long story, that comes to a climax and some form of closure in this week's Parsha, Parsha's Vayigash. But when you go through the entire story and all of the portions from Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash, Vayechi, the second half of Bereshis is dedicated to this story, the story of Yosef, while the first half is dedicated to the founding fathers of the world, Adam and Noach, and then Avraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, and the matriarch, Sarah, Rivka, Rachelea. The second half from Vayeshev is dedicated to Yosef and his brothers. So when you go through the whole story, it's obviously, you see how all the pieces of the puzzle come together. But there's one aspect that remains very perplexing, and that's what we want to address today. And that is how Yosef navigates the encounter with his brothers a long time before he reveals himself to them. There's something happening, but it's not very clear. The Torah is not explicit exactly what's happening. And let's go through, I'll remind you the narrative very briefly, and see the main points of where we are challenged and invited to look deeper and try to understand what the theme is, what the underlying theme is. So we all remember the story. Yosef was 17 years old. It starts off in Vayeshev. He was shepherding with his brothers. They disliked him. His father loved him tremendously. He made him a very special tunic, a multicolorful coat, Ksainas Pasim. The brothers see this love and they really have very negative feelings to Yosef. The Pasuk says they can't speak to him peacefully. And then he has a dream. In the first dream, he has all of these sheaves. Everybody is in the field binding, creating bundles, creating sheaves of grain. But his sheave, his bundle of grain stands up and all of their sheaves bow down to him. They tell him, so what? You're going to become the king. You're going to rule over us, which only causes more loathing. And then he has the second dream where the sun and the moon and 11 stars are all bowing down to him. And they get even more upset. His father rebukes him. His father says, this is ridiculous. What are we all coming to bow? Me and your mother, everybody's coming to bow to you. And the brothers are jealous, but it says his father, Va'aviv Shamares Hadavar Yaakov Avinu, kept it in mind. The story continues. Yaakov sends Yosef to see his brothers in Shechem. He arrives. They plot to kill him. Reuven is the one who says, let's not kill him. Let's throw him into a cistern, a boir, a pit. Reuven's intention is to bring him back to his father. But they listen to Reuven. His life is saved. They throw him into the cistern. They sit down to eat. Excuse me. And then a caravan of Yishmaelim come down. They're on the way to Egypt. And Yehuda is the one who suggests that instead of leaving Yosef there to die, let them sell Yosef as a slave. And that's what they do. Yosef is now sold as a slave to Potiphar in Egypt, one of Paro's ministers. Over there, he's very successful. And then his wife, Potiphar's wife, accuses him of promiscuity and he's thrown into prison. After 12 years in prison, he's at the age of 30, Paro dreams, and he summons Yosef to interpret the dreams. He's so blown away by Yosef. From a prisoner, he's appointed to the prime minister of Egypt, the viceroy, the second in command to Paro. This is after he interprets the dream that there's going to be 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. And Egypt needs a whole system in which it's going to be able to ration and put away food during the 7 years of plenty for the 7 years of famine. There are 7 years of plenty, and indeed, afterwards, the famine begins. And it's a devastating, devastating hunger. It affects the entire region, but in Egypt, they were prepared because of Yosef's executive skill and his ability over these 7 years of plenty to put away food in each city of Egypt, so therefore there is enough food to sustain the nation, and people are coming from everywhere to get grain in the land of Egypt. This is, of course, where the story takes the twist. And in Parshas Miketz, Yaakov Avinu sees there's grain in Egypt, and he tells his children, go bring food to us so that the whole family can be sustained. They come down to Egypt, 10 of the brothers. Remember, there were 12 brothers. Of course, Yosef was now in Egypt. The youngest brother was Binyamin, Yosef's youngest brother, his only full brother, the only brother that was born from his mother, Rachel. Everyone else was a half a brother because they had the same father but not the same mother besides Binyamin. So Binyamin stayed back and 10 brothers went down to Egypt to get food. They meet Yosef. They bow down to him. He's the ruler. He's the prime minister. He's the viceroy of Egypt. He's the second in command to Paro. There's nobody more powerful than they bow down to him. At that moment, Yosef recognizes them. They do not recognize him. The Torah says, Vayakir Yosef es echa v'hem lo yikiru. He remembers the dreams. And here, of course, they're all bowing down to him, all the brothers. And they're bowing down to him because they want grain, sheaves. Sheaves of grain is what they were looking for. So he remembers the dreams. That's all the Torah says. He remembers the dreams. But he speaks to them very harshly. Vayisnaker aleim. He makes believe he's a complete stranger. He doesn't know them. And he speaks very harshly and he accuses them of espionage. 10 people, 10 brothers came down here. You're not innocent. You're spies. And they have this whole conversation. No, we're innocent. No, you're spies. Yes, no, he arrests them. He throws them into, he incarcerates them into prison for 3 days. After 3 days, he tells them, how will I know that you're innocent people and that you're not lying if you bring down that last brother, Binyamin? You said that you have a brother home. and you're not spies. You left one brother home. You came here to get food. You're all sons of one father. How do I know you're not lying? One brother leave here. The other ones can go back with your food and bring back your last brother who's back home with his father. And if not, you're not coming back again. And your brother stays here. And he takes Shimon, and Shimon remains the prisoner as they are all dismissed to go home. At this moment, the brothers look at each other and they say to each other, we're guilty for this. Why are we guilty? We're guilty because years ago, we saw the distress of our brother who pleaded with us not to do what we did, and we ignored him. Of course, this reminds them of what happened more than 20 years earlier when they threw Yosef into the pit and sold him into slavery. So what now happens is they are extremely remorseful, and Yosef actually turns away and starts crying when he hears their remorse. When he hears their remorse of how they regret what they did, and they say, today, Aval Hashemim Anachnu, we're guilty. We're guilty in what happened because we were deaf to the cries of our brother. And of course, they're referring to him, to Yosef. As the Torah says, they don't know that he understands anything they're saying because officially he doesn't understand Hebrew. And there's an interpreter and a translator, Melitz Beinoisim, so nobody understands each other. He's speaking his language. They're speaking their language. They have no way of knowing that when they're talking to each other in their own language, the interpreter obviously wouldn't understand what they're talking about. How would he know the history? And how would they know that the viceroy understands their language and it's actually they're talking about him? So Yosef turns away to cry and he takes Shimon and he sends them off. He sends them back home. On the way home, one of them discovers the money in his bag. In other words, the money was returned to him. They're very scared. What is going on? What, as they say, what is Hashem doing to us? And when they come home, they discover that all of them have the money in their sacks. In other words, the money they gave to pay for their grain was returned to them, plus the grain. Something is very fishy. They tell Yaakov the whole story, and Yaakov says, you cannot take Binyamin. I've already lost my son Yosef. This is his only brother left. You take him, and what if he dies? And now I'm going to be finished. Yosef is gone. Shimon is gone, because Shimon is in prison in Egypt, and now Binyamin is going to be gone. Yaakov refuses to let Binyamin go, but they're hungry. The food is depleted. And that's when Yehuda approaches his father, and he tells his father, Anoichi arvenu, I am going to guarantee this boy. Miyadi tevakshenu, I'm the one who's taking full responsibility to bring this child back. And if I do not bring him back to you, as he puts it, v'chatasi elecha kol hayamim, I will carry the guilt for all the days of my life. This is me, I'm putting myself on the line to take full responsibility to bring back this child. And begrudgingly, Yaakov agrees there's no choice. They have to feed the family to send back Binyamin. When they come back the second time to Egypt, things seem much nicer, much more balabatish. Yosef's steward, Yosef's assistant, says, don't worry about the money. This was a gift from God. Don't worry. We're not accusing you of anything. You're invited for a feast with the prime minister. They brought him a gift that Yaakov prepared for him. And things seem beautiful. In fact, the Torah says, Yosef sets them around the table according to their age. And they're astonished by that. And then there's that moment of Vayishtu, Vayishkiru imay. They drink and they become intoxicated. As Rashi quotes the Gemara in Shabbos, Kuflamates, that since the day they sold Yosef, they have not had an ounce of wine. They did not drink any wine, and Yosef did not drink any wine. And this was the first time, even though they didn't know it was him, that they all drank together. And Yosef gives them gifts, but Binyamin's gifts are five times the amount of the other brothers. And they're sent home. They're sent home with a lot of grain. Everything, what do they say? All is well that ends well. They have Shimon back. They have Binyamin back. This turned out without any incident. It was beautiful. The viceroy was nice to them, was kind and graceful to them. They're on their way home. Okay, thank God. The story seems to end nicely. Of course, this is where the nightmare unfolds. As they're leaving the country and about to go home, Yosef sends the person in charge of his home, his steward, and he says, one of them stole my gevia, my silver goblet. my silver cup, my personal one, go and fetch it. And he goes and he pursues the brothers and he accuses them of this theft. They said it's impossible. If somebody stole it, he should die. Of course, they can't imagine nobody stole it. And he begins the search and it's in Binyamin's bag. The brothers tear their clothes from grief and they all go back to Egypt and they say, we'll all be your slaves. It's really Elokim Motzeh Savayin Avadecha. God is paying us for the sin of your servants. And Yosef says, Chas v'shalom, I don't do that. The one who stole, he shall be my slave. V'atem alu l'shalom al avichem. You go back to your father. You go back to your father. You're not guilty. This is a young man who stole my goblet. He shall remain here as my slave. Everybody else goes back. And that's how Parshas Miketz ends. V'atem alu l'shalom al avichem. At this moment, Yehuda approaches the prime minister of Egypt. And he speaks to him, and he gives him a very, very impassioned speech in the beginning of Vayigash. It's one of the longest speeches in the whole Torah. And the point of it, to sum it up, is, I cannot do this to my father. I guaranteed my father that I'm going to bring back my boy. V'nafshei k'shura b'nafshei, their souls are intertwined and interconnected. If I come back to our home without Binyamin, my father will die. He has been through so much pain with the death of his wife Rachel, and the death of his son Yosef, or the perceived death of his son Yosef. He says, V'achiv meis. And now the death of Binyamin, and now the disappearance of Binyamin as a slave. If I come back my father, without him, my father is going to die. And I have guaranteed him. I said, I will bring him back. And he finishes off. He says, Eich elel avi v'anar einenu iti pen. Eich elel avi v'anar einenu iti. How can I go back? How can I go up to my father without his child? Pen ere berasha yimtzes avi. Seeing the suffering that's going to befall my father. And this is the moment everything breaks. V'lo yachol Yosef l'isapik. Yosef can't contain himself anymore. He sends out all of his assistants. And the Torah says, lo amad ish itoy bisvada Yosef alecha. There was nobody present when Yosef reveals himself to his brothers. There was no human being. There was nobody else there. And Yosef breaks down sobbing. And he says, Ani Yosef ha'oid avichai. I am Yosef, is my father still alive? And the brothers simply are silent. They cannot say a word. They are startled. Nivhalu mipanov. They're startled, terrified, shocked, overwhelmed, bewildered, astounded. Yosef then brings them closer and he begins to comfort them. He tells them, don't get into a depression. Don't get infuriated. You did not sell me. Hashem sent me. He sent me to save the world from hunger. He sent me to create refuge for the whole family. There's going to be another five years of hunger. And Hashem sent me here. You did not send me. He sent me. Rather, go back home, tell my father I'm alive, and let's all relocate to Egypt where you'll be able to sustain yourselves and the families, because 5 years there will be no food anywhere else. And here you will enjoy tremendous prosperity and grace and blessings and so forth. And the story comes to a close. They go back home, of course. They tell Yaakov what happened, and Yaakov and the entire family relocate to Egypt. This narrative is clearly explicit in the Torah. I just summed it up very briefly. One question remains, and that is there a theme here in what Yosef was doing? When Yosef meets his brothers first, he might have revealed himself to them and say, hey, I'm Yosef. You remember? He doesn't do that. There is a series of events that you see are seriously orchestrated, and you want to understand what are these all about. What happens is the first time he meets them, immediately he creates obstacles in their path, and then he does it again and again. Their hearts get broken numerous times. So the first time, he's harsh to them. Something is wrong. They see this guy doesn't like them, and they're being accused of being spies. Of course, they weren't spies. They were people coming to get food. Then he arrests them, and then he arrests Shimon. And now he demands them to bring Binyamin, which also seems very difficult for Yaakov. He knew how much Yaakov loved him and loves Binyamin, and he is forcing Binyamin to be separated from Yaakov, even if temporarily. He's also forcing Yaakov to see that Shimon is gone. When they come back, they're without Shimon. So now Yaakov has lost two sons. Yosef is gone. He thought he was dead. And Shimon is in prison in Egypt. And then at the end, he hides this goblet in the sack of Binyamin, accusing him of being an outright ganav, a real thief who came to the party of the prime minister and had nothing better to do than steal his personal goblet, and therefore he has to remain a slave for the rest of his life. My question is, what does Yosef want? What is his ambition? What is the theme of the story? Is this a unified theme? What is going on here? The Torah, as usual, says the facts. It doesn't give us the background. What was Yosef thinking? Now we see his grace to his brothers. He invites them. He tells them not to be upset. He tells them not to be depressed. He tells them not to be infuriated. He says this entire story was orchestrated by Hashem. You did not sell me. I was sent. He invites them. He feeds them and their families. He treats them like kings, like royals, despite everything they did. Excuse me. Despite everything they did, he's so graceful to them. But this whole introduction to the story, before he reveals himself to them, is very, very different. Yosef is extremely tough, extremely harsh, and is touching so many chords of their hearts. What is the intention here of this whole plot? So this is what the Mefarshim, the commentators of the Tanakh, of the Torah, struggled with for many, many generations. Different interpretations, different perspectives. The Ramban, for example, asks this question. He says, why didn't he just tell them, I'm Yosef? And the Ramban says it was all about the dreams. He needed the dream. He felt the dreams were prophetic and they had to be fulfilled. And the dreams claimed that they're all going to bow down to him. The sun and the moon and the 11 stars and all the sheaves, which means Binyamin also has to bow down to him, which means Yaakov also is going to bow down to him, the sun and the moon and all the 11 stars. The 10 brothers bow down to him, but the 11th didn't, Yaakov didn't. So he needed to continue this drama in order to facilitate the dream. But others asked on that, why couldn't Yaakov come down to Egypt? Why couldn't Yosef reveal himself now and Yaakov would come down to Egypt and bow down to the prime minister? Even later, Yaakov bowed down to him after he knew he was Yosef. At the end of his life, Yaakov asked Yosef to bury him in Eretz Yisrael when he passes away, and Yaakov bows down to Yosef. And Binyamin also would have bowed down to him. In fact, he would have facilitated and implemented and executed, expedited the fulfillment of the dreams much swifter. Others, not traditional commentators, but others said this was about revenge. Yosef said, you know, they hurt me, I'm going to hurt them. Let me give them a taste of their own kasha, as they say, their own poison, their own music. So basically, Yosef is punishing them. He's penalizing them. Yes, he arrests them. He arrests their brother. It's a form of inflicting pain on them. But when you read the story, even objectively, you see that that's not the story. And I'll tell you why. In the whole Tanakh, there's nobody who cries as many times as Yosef. The Torah mentions people crying, but not close to the amount of times that Yosef cries. I counted. Throughout the story, Yosef sobs 8 times. And that's only what the Torah says. In Midrashim, there are many more times he sobs. But the fact that the Torah mentions, at any point when there's an emotion, Yosef starts crying. He hears that the brothers are remorseful about what they did, and Yosef is crying. He cries 8 times throughout this entire story. Ultimately, he will cry, of course, when he meets Binyamin, he cries. Before he reveals himself to his brothers, he cries. Later, he cries on Binyamin. He cries with his brothers. He cries, of course, with his father. He cries after his father's death. He cries after the brothers talk to him after his father's death when they think he's going to take revenge. Generally, people who are in a modality of revenge don't cry. It's a different attitude. It's a different energy. They're harsh. They're tough. This is their enjoyment. You could see throughout the whole story how much Yosef is feeling his emotions and feeling the pain of this entire story. And then when he finally reveals himself, he says, don't be upset, don't be infuriated. This man who was just busy with revenge, those are not the words we would expect for him to come out of his mouth and say, this is not really about you. This was God, this was Hashem's doing. So we're left with the question, why did Yosef do all this? Even if he wanted to delay it a little bit for whatever reason, why put them through this crucible and excruciating journey? The truth is, when you read the story carefully, it's really an extraordinary tapestry that Yosef created. You don't see it right away at first sight. You have to read deeply into the story. But it's addressed with maybe one of the biggest questions on this whole story. Why didn't Yosef send a message to his father that he was alive? He knew that his father loved him. His father had a special liking to him. In fact, that was one of the causes that created the whole animosity. Egypt is not very far from Israel. It's very close. Even in those days, you couldn't fly an hour flight. You went on a carry, you went on a donkey, you went on a camel. You went on a coach, went with your coach. So you talk about a journey of a few days. People were coming and going all the time. Yosef was 30 years old when he became the prime minister of Egypt. He was sold into slavery as a 17-year-old. The brothers only came down when he was 38 years old, because for 7 years of plenty, he was 30. And then there were 7 years of plenty, that's 37. And then started the hunger, he was 38. And that's when the brothers came down. And then he was 39, the second year. And he was sold when he was 17. So 22 years he was separated from his father. He was a slave in Potiphar's house. He could have sent a message to his father, I'm alive. Even if he was a slave, you could say he couldn't go himself, okay? But he was in charge of Potiphar's house. He couldn't send a letter, he couldn't send a message, he couldn't find somebody going. Even if you'd say he was a slave and Potiphar would have let him, and then he was a prisoner, so there was no mail. Okay, but now you're the prime minister of Egypt. You certainly have the power to send a letter. There were no telegraphs. I know he couldn't send a text or a WhatsApp or call. Zolzain. But send somebody. People are coming all the time. Send a message to your father, you're alive. He did not. 22 years, he did not send a single message to Yaakov. Even though Yaakov was grieving this whole time. What is this about? This was raised over the generations. This big question. What really was happening? Remember, before the hunger, he was a prime minister of Egypt for 7 years of plenty. There was comfort. There was prosperity. There was no crisis. He was preparing for crisis. Why didn't he want to send a message to Yaakov? The Ramban asks this question. Many, many Mefarshim asked this question over the generations. It's very difficult to understand what happened there. And then finally, when the brothers come, and you have your natural messengers, he's still not doing it. He arrests them, he sends them back, they come back again, they're going back, and now he accuses them of theft, he accuses Binyamin of theft, and now he reveals himself. So there's another explanation of this whole story that we want to present today, Be'ezer Hashem. This is compiled from many commentators, including the Ramban, the Rashbam, the Sefarno, the Klayokar, the Abar Benel, the Alshich, Eirat Teira of the Tzemach Tzedek, Iturei Teira, Arugas Habaisim, a wonderful essay by a scholar in Israel, Rabbi Yaakov Madan, an essay by Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, and the commentary of Nechama Leibowitz. I compiled from a lot of these sources. What really emerges as a very, very powerful tapestry, especially Rabbi Yaakov Madan and Rabbi Sachs, who brought it all together very beautifully. And I want to change the subject for a moment and ask you to go to your first sources in the source sheet. And it looks like we're going to be changing the subject. We won't, but it's like one speaker once said, I don't digress, I just extrapolate. Rambam Hilchis Tshuva, Perik Beis, Halacha Aleph. Rambam, Maimonides, The Laws of Repentance, Chapter 2. We all know one of the key concepts in Judaism is called tshuva. Tshuva is a complex term, which is usually translated as repentance, but really the accurate translation is return. Tshuva means to return. The whole Tanakh, the whole Tanakh is filled, saturated with this idea of the ability of people to reinvent themselves, of return, rediscover who they are, etc. The Rambam, who was the great codifier of halacha, defines what is tshuva. What does it mean, I did tshuva? So he says in the second chapter of his Laws of Tshuva, Ezi tshuva gemura, you have it in the Hebrew and English, Ezi tshuva gemura, what does it mean to do complete tshuva? What is complete tshuva? Zesha bali yade davar shavar bai v'efshe b'yade la'asayisi upirij v'le'asav b'nei tshuva, lo'y me'yirev v'lo'y me'kishlin kayach. The same exact opportunity for sin presents itself to the person, he can still do it, yet refrains not because of lack of strength or fear, but because of conviction. So the Rambam is saying, what tshuva gemura is, sometimes I may make some serious mistakes in my life, do things I shouldn't have done, or be passive in cases I shouldn't have been passive, and later I won't make those same mistakes, but you know why? I'm frail, I'm weak, I'm afraid, I don't have energy anymore, I'm done. Fine, technically it's good, I'm not doing it. But the Rambam says that's not tshuva gemura. Tshuva gemura is actually the same story happens again. And I could be there to repeat it, because I still have the same strength and the same vigor and the same opportunities and the same resources to be able to do whatever I've done. I'm still dealing with the same situation. And yet, I respond differently. Says, this is real tshuva, because it's not just I'm not doing it, there's a change in the person. You know, sometimes a person, they changes their place, they change their a person grows up, their age changes, okay, so the circumstances are not here. So that's not tshuva gemura. Tshuva gemura means all the pieces are in front of me, and yet I make a different move in this chess game of life. Umayi tshuva, and what is tshuva b'chlal? This is tshuva gemura. Complete tshuva. What is tshuva? Rambam says, Sheyazav achoyte chetei, v'yasire b'machshavte, v'yigmer b'libo shelo yaseyu oit. It's for the person who did the transgression or the sin, the mistake, to leave it, to abandon it, and to remove it from his or her mind, v'yigmer b'libo shelo yaseyu oit, and to resolve in the person's heart not to do it again. V'chein yisnachem al sha'avar. And also to regret the past. So the Rambam here says, you see, interesting. What's tshuva? What's the definition of tshuva? Two things. One is, I say, I'm done with this. I'm done. Bye-bye. This behavior, these actions, this attitude, this perspective, these sins, these words, thoughts, patterns, whatever it is, bye-bye. Yazov. I abandon it and I make a resolution. This is not part of my life. And then the Rambam says, but there's also one more thing. V'chein yisnachem, it's regret for what happened. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. These are known in halacha as Kabbalah ala haba and Charata ala avar. Kabbalah ala haba means a resolution for tomorrow, for today and tomorrow and the future. Charata ala avar means remorse for the past. So if it's between a person and another person, I want to do tshuva. One thing is, what's the future going to look like? How am I going to react? How am I going to respond? How will I behave in the future? That's the first question of tshuva. The second thing is, can I apologize for the past? It's interesting that he speaks about the future before he speaks about the past. You would think he would say, first feel bad for the past, and then make a resolution for the future. But it's actually a very powerful idea. Because what he's saying, the real definition of tshuva is, I'm done. If I'm really done, it means I don't like what happened. I don't like what happened. Because sometimes we could get mixed up and think tshuva is about guilt. That's not tshuva. That's called guilt. That's very different than tshuva. Guilt just means I'm horrible, I'm bad, I mess up everything, my life is a curse. I think some of us know what that feels like. It sounds like tshuva. It's not. That's why the Rambam does not put that first. He doesn't say tshuva means, oh, I'm such a sick, detached, disassociated, narcissistic, meshugana, addictive, traumatized, or whatever, wounded person. Okay? Those voices are there, but that's not tshuva. That's usually a very different voice than tshuva. Tshuva is that I'm actually taking the courage, what's happening from now on. Because I'm serious about that, it's because I don't like what happened yesterday. So yeah, I'm feeling remorse about what happened yesterday, what happened this morning, and therefore, tomorrow it's not going to happen anymore. So the Rambam defined here, as tshuva, as three things. The first thing is the resolution for the future. The second thing is the remorse for the past. And then there is complete tshuva, that I have the opportunity to do it all over again, and I do it differently. That's how we started. That's tshuva gemura. Not because I'm weak, not because I don't have the opportunity. I do, but I do it differently. And the Rambam says, V'yoyed alav yedeya talumish le'yoshev l'zah chet la'aylam. The knower of secrets shall be able to testify that this person is not going to return to this sin. A person ought to confess verbally, to express with one's lips that which we're experiencing in our heart. And that's known as vidui. Like we do al chayt or ashamnu, or we tell somebody, I'm sorry, verbally. It's really all an emotion. Regret is inside my heart. Resolve is inside my heart. But there is the concept of vidui where I actually express it with my lips, and I say, I apologize to you for doing so and so. This is how he formulates what tshuva is. The question is, what's the source for this? The Torah speaks about tshuva, but doesn't give this clear outline of the different components of tshuva. And it may be that the Rambam studied very well Sefer Bereishis, and the Rambam watched what Yosef did with his brothers. And when he watched what Yosef did with his brothers, the story was really formulating for the first time in history the mechanism of tshuva in halacha. The mechanism of tshuva in Jewish law, that's what's basically happening here in the story. Because when you read well what Yosef did, this was not cruelty to his brothers. It was actually very, very profound love. There was something broken in the family. We should always make this disclaimer that we're talking about people who were extremely lofty and very lofty souls. So everything we say is always relative to understand their lofty spiritual levels. But there was something that was broken in the family. Something that was very painful in the family. Obviously, there was the lack of respect and love, as the Torah says. They loathed him. They were jealous of him. Yosef spoke negatively about them to his father. His father was upset with him. They were upset with him. And it turns out into a colossal tragedy and catastrophe where they throw him into a pit. They strip him from his tunic. They sell him into slavery. And Yaakov is now grieving and says, I'm going to go down to my grave in grief. These things don't disappear. I snap my finger and it's all gone. Obviously, healing is needed. There's something very, very off. There's a spiritual infection. There's a spiritual cancer. There's a spiritual disease relative to their level that's raging in the genesis of the Jewish existence, where there could be such discord and such contention. And even if everybody meant well and had good intentions and felt they were doing the right thing, the results were catastrophic. The results were that Yaakov himself feels that his whole life was destroyed. There's nothing he can do to find comfort. His sons and daughters tried to comfort him. Vayimayin leisnachem. He refused to be comforted. And he said, I will go down to to the abyss in tears and sobs. Yosef made a life for himself. Not easy, but he became the prime minister of the superpower of the time. He was now the second most powerful person in the ancient world. That's not bad for a little Jewish boy from Hebron. 17-year-old Jewish kid dreaming, who was a prisoner, who had no hope, and suddenly is the second to the most powerful person in the ancient world. Remember, ancient Egypt was a superpower. So Yosef did very, very well for himself. He did well, he got married, he had children, he named them Menashe and Ephraim with all of the symbolism the Torah says. That's fine. in many ways, Yosef is fine. But there's a deeper question. What about his brothers? Are they fine? What happened to this family over the last 20 years? What happened? Yosef doesn't know. He had no contact with them. He doesn't know what happened to the family. He could say, hey, I'm Yosef. Wow. And they would right away throw the party. Right? Yaakov would come meet him. There would be a huge seder. There would be signs everywhere. They would invite the whole Egypt. It would be a Rebbe Shechasana, but not Stam. With all the photographers, it would be Gevaldik. But there would be one question that Yosef and everybody else would have to answer. Who is celebrating here? Is this a party for the masses? Or has something really changed? Deep, deep spiritual infections. Deep pain and dysfunction. Let's speak about our own lives, our own families. That sits in the heart for generations. I can't just snap my finger, throw a party, and make believe it's good. That may be nice, and it's wonderful to be civil, and civility is always a good thing. But that doesn't mean there was real healing. That doesn't mean there was real transformation. And this is where we find Yosef's greatness yet once again. All of his trials and tribulations caused him to reinvent himself. As we spoke in the last class, Vayeshev, you remember about Yosef's stages, where he discovers himself as a slave and rediscovers himself in prison. And it's incredible. And you could see the man that Yosef has become. Not that he was a small person before, but he becomes a person to the point that the Torah even takes out the word biyada. It's not that Hashem is channeling success through his hand, because even his hand is a complete channel. To the point that when he meets Paray, and remember, Paray is the most powerful person in the ancient world, and this was not a democracy. So the most powerful person meant the most powerful person. You couldn't vote him in and out after 4 years. You couldn't. This was the king. He was a demigod. He was worshipped. You're talking about a demigod with absolute, absolute power. If he didn't like what you looked like, you can come out with a head shorter. You're talking about ancient monarchs who were dictators. And finally, Yosef. Imagine Yosef. He didn't have a father. He didn't have a mother. He didn't have brothers. They're the ones who did it. So he had nobody in the world. And he's a prisoner for 12 years. And there's no process, you know. There's lawyers. The newspaper people are going to fight for you. He's going to be there for life. A man with such potential, with such wisdom. And finally, he's summoned to the king out of the blue. He didn't expect it. He's summoned to the king. And Paray says, I heard you're an expert on interpreting dreams. I heard that. I had a dream. Nobody can explain. I heard you're the expert. Now think, if you're Yosef, you're 30 years old, your childhood and innocence were robbed from you when you were 17, and you're now 30 years old. It's a long time, 13 years of absolute pain and suffering and anguish, most of the time in a pit in Egypt, in a boir. What would you tell Paray at that moment? Like, you know, this is the lottery of all times. It's not $300 million lottery, it's a $300 billion lottery. It's a priceless lottery. The most powerful person looks at you and says, I had a dream and I need you to interpret it. I heard you're an expert. The natural reaction is, you got the right person. You do it very humbly, right? You do it very humbly. But of course, Your Majesty, you got the right person. I'm here at your service, right? That would be the thing to do. What does Yosef do? He ruins it. Yosef says, Biladai, sorry, I can't do it. Biladai, it's not me. Halakim yanes shleim parai. Biladai, I'm not the person. I cannot help you. Halakim yanes shleim parai. Wow. And of course, that's what touched Paray more than anything else. This is where he saw a completely different type of person. Now when Yosef meets his brothers, he sees them. They're there, getting grain. The big question he has to ask himself is, I have changed over 20 years. Did they change over 20 years? The sad thing about life is people could go through 20 years and not change. Circumstances may change. I may move to a new house. I may move to a new community. I may make more money. I may make less money. Obviously, there's a lot of different changes, but I did not change. I'm still wearing the same glasses. I'm still carrying the same judgment. I'm still reacting in the same way. I did not change. Of course, I become a little more mature. I learn about things, but it's like, you know, what do they say? You can't teach an old dog new tricks. I told you once, the Medrash says in Kehelas, it's fascinating that a person goes through seven stages in life. Don't get insulted, it's talking about men. The first stage is when he's born, it says he's a king. Like he's an aristocrat, right? Everybody's showing off what he looks like, how much does he weigh. Nobody asks me how much I weigh, thank God. But then, how much do you weigh? You look like your mother, you look like your father. He's black, he's blonde. Oh, the face, he's so cute, everybody wants to hold him. The Medrash says he's a king. When he's 2 years old, it says he's like a pig. He's in the sewer systems. He's in ever it's dirty, a getarain, like a chaz. Then when he's 10 years old, he's like a goat, a springt, he's jumping everywhere. When he's 20, he's like a horse, grooming himself to impress the women. And then when he gets married, he's like a donkey, a schlept and schlept and schlept. He's just schlepping. And then at the time he has kids to marry off, it says he's like a dog. You need so much chutzpah to survive in this crazy world. He's just barking. He's just barking. And then, so he goes from a king to a pig, to a goat, to a horse, to a donkey, to a dog. And the Medrash says, and what's the conclusion? When he gets old, he becomes a chimpanzee, a monkey. Doesn't explain why. So they say, yeah, now you have to do tricks for the Einiklach to entertain them. So he's doing all these monkey tricks. But the Kutzker Rebbe once said something very profound. He says, Kaifim, which are monkeys or chimps, they know how to emulate people. So he says, when I become older, I become like a chimp. I start emulating myself. I start copying myself. That creativity, the courage to reinvent myself is gone. Now I do things today because I did them yesterday. I did them yesterday because I did them the day before. I go into my comfort zone and it's a very comfortable place to remain. So who am I copying? I'm copying myself. I have no more the energy or the stamina to be able to expand my consciousness, to be able to open myself up to a new reality. Yosef did that every single day of his life. Now he's looking at his brothers. What happened over these last 20 years? How is he going to find out? These are not things you could find out through a conversation. These are things that touch you at the core of your soul. How are you reacting to things that are very, very meaningful, things that are very personal? What happened in my marriage over the last 20 years? What happened in my relationship with my children over the last 20 years? What happened with my relationship with myself over the last 20 years? That's probably the deepest. What happened with my relationship with Hashem over the last 20 years? What happened and where am I today? And this is where Yosef begins a great experiment. And it's fascinating. Everything he does is so precise and ingenious and particular and intricate that really allows him to be able to, and allows them to see the evolution of the family. So what's the first thing he does? He accuses them of being spies. They're not. They're innocent people. He accuses them of a crime they did not commit. And he knows very well they didn't commit it. He knows they're not spies. He knows who they are. He knows they came for food like everybody else. So he's accusing them of a crime they didn't do. That's why people say, oh, he just wanted to torture them. He just wanted to persecute them. He just wanted to hurt them. And then he arrests them for 3 days. And then he sends them home and he keeps Shimon there. And they come home without Shimon. What's all this about? He accuses them of a crime that they did not do, knowing and hoping that will remind them of a crime that they did do. That's the key. They're being accused of something that they're completely innocent about. Why is this happening to me? I'm a good person. But it's challenging them. Can you think of something that you did do? And they do. And it's fascinating. The Medrash says they looked back for 20 years to see what they did. They couldn't find anything. They looked yesterday. They looked a month, a year. So the Medrash says they looked for 20 years. They couldn't find anything. And then they knew there's one thing. And they go back to that moment. That difficult, painful, dark moment when they threw their brother into the cistern. Into the pit. And if you see it, it's a second source. Miketz Membeis Chafalef. Vayomru Ishel Achiv. Second source. They said to one another, Aval Hashemim Anachnu. Alachinu Asher Ha'inu Tzaras Nafshei Bishanano Yelenu V'loi Shamanu Alkein Bo Aleinu Atzara Hazos. Indeed, we are guilty. It's because of our brother. The brother they don't know they're talking to. We witnessed the distress of his soul when he begged, when he pleaded with us not to harm him, and we were deaf. That is why this trouble has come upon us. For the first time, Yosef has heard their profound remorse. They're saying, we were deaf to our brother. He was pleading with us. And we did not, v'lo shamano, we did not hear. We did not want to hear, or we did not hear. Al-Kain Ba'aleinu Atzaris. That's why we're being accused of espionage. That's why we're being arrested. That's why Shimon is being separated from us. We know that we're not spies. We didn't do anything wrong. Aval Hashemim Anachnu. This is not because he's a Rasha Merusha. He's a sick man. He's a tyrant. He's a Meshuggah dictator, worse than Parai. That's usually what you would expect them to say, no? Ah, Rasha Merusha. Ah, Meshuggah. They're sitting over there. He arrests them. They're innocent. They should start demonizing him, which would have been normal because he was accusing them of something. But they had a good education. They were educated by Yaakov. So they understood, you can demonize him. We don't know who he is. But if it happened to you, something else is happening here. Ultimately, Ein Adam Noikef Etzboi Elim Kein, the Gemara says, Ein Adam Noikef Etzboi Malmata Elim Kein Machrizim Malmaila. Every experience that a person has is orchestrated by Hashem. So that means if we're having this experience, he may be the person who's bringing it to us. But there's something that we have to look into. There's something I need to take accountability for. There's something I want to reflect on. What is happening inside of me? And they find something from more than 20 years ago. So basically, when they are separated from Shimon, when Yosef tells them, you go home and Shimon stays here. When they're in prison, and remember, prison in Egypt was a burial, was a pit. So what just happened? They went back to a pit. They were now put in a pit. They were accused of espionage. And suddenly, they know they're going back to their father without one of their brothers. What do you think happened? In their mind, Yosef helped them go back to that moment. Go back to that day or that night in Shechem. And relive it. They relived it. And Shimon here is not a mistake, because he wouldn't do it to Reuven, because Reuven is the one who saved him. Reuven is the one who said, don't kill him, throw him into the pit. Shimon was the second oldest brother. And according to Chazal, Shimon is the one who actually threw him into the pit. So the person who threw him into the pit is now separated. What do you think happened now? They're coming home to Yaakov without Shimon. That day, or that night, that they attempted to erase from their consciousness, because they felt they're doing the right thing. For whatever reason, they felt Yosef has no future in the Jewish family. He's going to endanger the family. He will jeopardize them. And if Yosef is there, they're not there. It's either them or him. So they tried to erase it from their consciousness. They thought they were doing the right thing. And suddenly, they can't erase it from their consciousness. It all comes back to them. All is what happens in life. Sometimes I do things, and in my mind, I tell myself, oh, I had to, I was forced, this was the right thing. My idealism was at play, but then I realized, maybe I had intentions, but ultimately, I made a serious mistake. Ultimately, I abandoned my soul, I abandoned my God, I abandoned my conscience. I camouflaged it as idealistic or as moral or as ethical, but ultimately I was doing the wrong thing, and that's what happens here. Ashemim anachnu. At that moment, Yosef saw the first step of tshuva play out. There was real remorse. They weren't faking it. Nobody heard it. They wouldn't know anybody heard. They were talking to each other, and they said, we are guilty for all of this. We were deaf to our brother's cries, and that's why we're experiencing this. And Reuven actually responded to them. Reuven said, I told you don't sin against the child. Because Reuven was the one who tried to save Yosef then. And Yosef turns away and cries. He doesn't want them to see, but he cries. But now he goes one step further. So now the story is over. They did tshuva. No, no. Remember, tshuva has three steps. So look at Yosef's strategy. There's a resolution for the future. Okay, I could feel bad. I'd feel bad. I wouldn't have done it. Tomorrow, I'll do it again. So Yosef does now something which he himself will not witness. He can't. But he knows exactly what's going to happen. What does he say? I want you to bring Binyamin down. Now he knows that Yaakov doesn't want Binyamin to separate from him. So what's going to have to happen for them to bring Binyamin down to Egypt? What's going to have to happen? Huh? Very good. They're going to have to swear, promise to Yaakov, never again. There's no way Yaakov is letting Binyamin go out of his hand. He lost Yosef. He lost Shimon. He lost Rachel. As Rashi says, Yaakov told them, Yehuda told Yosef, Yaakov said to them, you know, when I have Binyamin, I find some comfort for Rachel who's gone. I find some comfort for Yosef who's gone. He's like the last relic of the family. Rachel died and Yosef died. He thought Yosef died and all I have is Binyamin. You take Binyamin and the nuclear family, you know, Yaakov wanted to marry Rachel and they had two kids. She had two kids, Yosef and Binyamin, and it's all destroyed. Just like his whole family. I don't know if you saw this Chanukah, it was a bar mitzvah of a boy, Ariel Zohar. Did you see about that bar mitzvah? Ariel Zohar lived in a kibbutz near Oz, at the border of Gaza. 12-year-old kid, very athletic, well fit. So what did he do every morning, early in the morning? He went for a run. He went for a long, good run. And Simchas Torah in the morning was no different. He went for his run. So he left his house very early in the morning, left the kibbutz and went on a run. Moments later, the terrorists came in. They went into his home. They murdered his father, whose name is Yaniv Zohar. They murdered his mother, whose name is Yasmin. And they murdered both of his sisters, Tchelet and Keshet. He wasn't home. So he's the only one to survive from his entire family. Father and mother and both siblings were gunned down that morning of October 7th. By the time he came back, he already saw what's going on, and he was saved. This was a few weeks before his bar mitzvah. He has a surviving grandfather who's 90 years old, who's a Holocaust survivor. So that's where he went to, his grandparents. So one of the people working in Zaka, he's in a special unit of Zaka, went over to him and said, is there anything I can do for you? He said, yeah. My father prepared tefillin for me for my bar mitzvah. And it's in the house. It's the only thing I'll have for my father. Can you get me those tefillin? Now, this was right after Simchas Torah. They were not allowing anybody to come back to those kibbutzim because they were under fire. They were still sending rockets and there were terrorists roaming. So they said, you can't go. You can't go here. This is completely, completely not allowed anybody to enter. But Zaka pleaded, and this is a guy from a special unit, so the commander said, I give you 6 minutes in the house. Shesh takot. 6 minutes. Now the house was burned down. They burnt down the houses. So he comes into the house, and he shared the story on a video. He came into the house, it's all burnt. And he has 6 minutes, and he's running and running, and he finds the tefillin with Ariel's name. He takes it out, his friend takes out some other stuff just to give him like an album of pictures or whatever they could find, you know, that may be valuable. And they ran out. This was all under tremendous, tremendous security. As they were in the house, as they were coming out of the house, they had to have this security from the army. And this man from Zaka brought back the tefillin to Ariel. And he said, you know, this man from Zaka, he said, I didn't cry all these days because I couldn't. I just had to work. But at that moment, he just let it all go. And he was sobbing with Ariel. And the grandfather was 90 years old. Turns to his grandson and to this person from Zaka. He says, listen, I lost both of my parents in the Holocaust. I was 14. I didn't think I'll have a day like this where I'll see such death here, but I also see a grandson and I built a family and the entire extended family in our homeland. So he tells Ariel, your future is also going to be exceptionally bright. This Chanukah was his bar mitzvah. So who came to the bar mitzvah? Rabbi Lau. Rabbi Lau was the former chief rabbi of Israel. Rabbi Lau was born in 1938 or 1939. So he's, I think, 86 years old. L'arichas yamim v'shanim tayvus. Rabbi Lau spoke. Rabbi Lau lost his family in the Holocaust in Treblinka. Ugh. So Rabbi Lau says to Ariel, he says, my bar mitzvah was in 1950. He was born in 1937. My father wasn't there. My mother wasn't there. Most of my siblings were gone. Who was there? My uncle and my aunt, like you. Your uncle and your aunt, and you have a grandfather. And Rabbi Lau said that, the tragedy is very, very profound. But just know that whatever you ever need, I'm here for you. I had the same bar mitzvah like you. And just know how many people love you. And the whole nation loves you, and the whole country loves you. And he took a picture with him putting on the tefillin of his father, and that tefillin he got from his grandfather, who was the Holocaust survivor. And it was just incredibly painful and incredibly moving. And Rabbi Lau told him, how he started from scratch. He had nothing. And he became the chief rabbi of Israel. And his father told him, before he went to the gas chambers, his father told him that we are 38 generations of Rabbanim. 38 generations. Father, 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 back to the Tosfos Yom Tov. And his father told, he was a little kid, but his father told his older brother Naftali, who was 15, if you survive and his son survives, make sure he could continue. He said, I became the chief rabbi of Israel. And he told his son, this boy, Ariel, I will always be here for you. Like, consider me a brother. You're 13, I'm 86, but consider me a brother. And they hugged and they embraced. It was such moments where you see, pain in all of its, in all of its depth, which is really unfathomable. And it's at that moment you also see the power, the soul of people. Huh? Utsma, yeah, utsma. So I reminded myself of this because Yaakov was saying, I don't have anybody. I lost Rachel, I lost Yosef. The only one left to this family is Binyamin. Yosef knows this. So how is he going to get Yaakov to let them take Binyamin? Only if they do the second part of tshuva. They're going to have to tell Yaakov, this will not happen again. The next brother who falls into our hands is going to be safe. How did Yosef disappear? Yaakov doesn't know they sold him, but what happened? Yaakov sent Yosef to them. And on the way or on the way back, something happened. Yosef was gone. Taref, taref. He was devoured. This will not happen to Binyamin. Yosef doesn't see them doing this because he's not going back to Eretz Yisrael, but he knows this is going to happen. That's exactly what happens. And who's the one who gets up and does it? Yehuda. Yehuda stands up and tells Yaakov, Anochi ervenu miyadi tevakshenu. I will guarantee him. And the words of Yehuda are so powerful because first Reuven says, you could kill both of my kids if I don't bring back Binyamin. And Yaakov doesn't want to listen to that. But when Yehuda speaks to him, Yehuda says these words, if I don't bring him back to you and put him right here in front of you, I will remain guilty for all the days of my life. And Chazal say, even in Olam Haba. Yaakov now agrees. Yaakov agrees. Yehuda says, take my word. All I can give you is my word, but my soul is in this word. And when Yosef sees Binyamin came to Egypt, he doesn't have to ask questions. He knows exactly what happened in the house. He knows exactly the second part of tshuva happened. They didn't only regret the past and say, yeah, we're guilty, life is horrible, we were horrible brothers. There's a different attitude in this family. They know how to say, never again, this is going to change. We're going to show up, we're going to be present. Great, wow. But wait, there's one more part of tshuva. What's the last part of tshuva? What does the Rebbe say? It's tshuva gemura. What's complete tshuva? Complete tshuva is the same opportunity comes up again and I react differently. And we all know this in all forms of healing. When do I know that I healed? When do I know that I'm on the path of healing? If I just move away to a different situation and never deal with anything again, okay, if you can do that, sometimes that's great and sometimes necessary. But the real thing is, the same words are spoken to you again, but you react differently. Maybe last year or 5 years ago, my spouse said these same words and they triggered me to the point of becoming emotionally overwhelmed, emotionally detached, fight, flight, fawn, freeze. And now, a year, two, 3 years later, I hear the same words and I could react the same way and a part of my brain wants to go there. So, we're going to do it differently. We're going to do it differently. I have control now. I know who I am. I know who I'm not. I know what part is my trauma. I know what part is my soul. I'm going to do it differently. Wow, that's true of a Gemara. You had the exact same opportunity. You did it differently. The question is, how can that happen? And this is where Yosef conducts what you may call a master stroke. This is the stroke of a master, of a true maestro. What does he do? He invites them to his home. He's graceful. They're all drinking. He said, Vayishtu Vayishkru, they're all drinking. So you can understand this was a suda. It was a fabrengen. It was a feast. Kiyad HaMelech. And obviously they felt there's something very powerful here because it's the first time they're drinking. And it's not clear why they're drinking. If they didn't drink since Yosef was sold, why'd they suddenly start drinking now? The Maharal of Prague, the Gerari, says something very interesting, profound. He says, why did Yosef take out all these drinks? They said to themselves, they didn't know the whole story. He's accusing us of being spies. So he wants to get us drunk. When people are drunk, the secrets come out and we'll spill the beans. But we know we're not spies. So we don't care to spill the beans. I don't care if I'm drunk. What's the worst thing you're going to hear? You're going to hear my dark secrets. You know what? My secrets are not so dark in terms of espionage, at least. You're not going to hear from me that I'm a spy. So they're fine. Let's get drunk. That's what the Maharal says. Of course, this is all from their perspective, thinking that Yosef thinks they're spies. Because we interpret life always from our perspective. Oh, you're giving me a lot of wine because you think I'm a spy. I never see things from your perspective. It just shows you how they thought. From Yosef's perspective, it was something very different. Yosef really, really wanted to make them feel very, very comfortable. Yosef really was beginning to celebrate a family reunited. In fact, when Yosef sets them around the table, it says, Vayitmu ishal re'eyu. Each brother to his friend wondered how the man knew where they should be seated. It's the first time they're called friends. The first and last. The word re'eyu, friend, is only in that moment. Usually they're brothers, they're biological brothers. But can they be friends? That's very different. You know, like somebody says, I love my family, but how do I start liking my family? How do you like the people you love? It's not so simple. I love you, but can I like you? It's very different. You know, there's loving the people you like. Can't always do that, but there's liking the people you love. They're family, they're brothers, but is there real trust? So this is the first time they're called Re'eyu. Yosef feels they already went through the two processes of tshuva. This is a very special moment. And here is his master stroke. They're leaving. This is unexpected. And the reason it has to be unexpected is because that's where you're going to see instinctively how they respond. When things are expected, you have time to prepare. But they were so comfortable in his house, they thought the nightmare was over. He sends them home, but not before putting his private goblet into Binyamin's sack. So now suddenly, Binyamin is discovered as a thief, as a ganav, which means he has to become a slave by the king. That's the rule. You steal, you become my slave. You did it. I didn't do it. Binyamin did it. What might have been the natural reaction? They might have said, listen, you know, Binyamin stole something. What are we supposed to do? Like, yeah, I guarantee to bring him back if he's a mensch. If he behaves, I'll bring him back. You know, I take you somewhere and you steal and you start committing crimes. Yeah, you're going to get arrested. What am I supposed to do? I'm not a miracle worker. That would have been a very rational, sane response. In fact, the Medrash even says, and this is so powerful, that they turned to Binyamin, and whether it means verbally or in thought, but they said something or they thought something, and they said, you're just like your mother. She stole her father's stuff. back in Parshas Vayetze, she stole her father's trophim, father's idols, or different interpretations of what trophim are. Oh, like mother, like son. What is that about? You see, that's how the brain works. We go back to the situations. We go back to our familiar neural pathways. We accuse. You're the thief. You're the ganav. Of course, Binyamin was innocent. But the way I think is, you're the thief. You're the ganav. I can't deal with you. Oh, we sold Yosef. We had a good reason to do it. Ein ganav, atzveit ganav. He was haughty. He was arrogant. He was narcissistic. Now his brother is stealing. And you justify it. And I am back stuck in my old neural way pathways, my old ways of thinking. This was a thought. Would this be their reaction or not? But wait, you can't compare. Yosef, they were jealous of. Yosef got that multicolorful tunic from the father. Yosef, they were envious of. It wasn't just Yosef was from a different mother. They had a personal reason to be jealous of him. What about Binyamin? And this is where Yosef did something at that party. When you read it in Chumash, it's just like, okay. What he did at that party was, it says, he gave them all gifts. But the gifts of Binyamin were 5 times the amount. What was that about? So there's different interpretations. Why do it right now? He gave Binyamin a gift 5 times the amount of what he gave the other brothers. 5 times the amount. What's the Torah trying to say? It's very hard not to escape the conclusion. Yosef was literally organizing an experiment. This was a prepared experiment. Again, Binyamin is treated better than everybody else. Binyamin has more favor. Binyamin has more grace. Right away, the ancient jealousy can be triggered. Rachel's kids, you know? Rachel's kids! The aristocrats, Mackenzie and Chapin. These are the princes, the crown princes. The favorites. Dad's favorites. We can't touch them. And now, even the prime minister of Egypt sees that he's the best. And naturally, it engenders that feeling, you know, we're not in the same boat. He's treated differently. So now, when he's caught as a thief, what might be the natural response? There's nothing we can do. He stole. He has to suffer the consequences. There's really nothing to do. This is the law. He has to be a slave. And that's how Yosef ends Parshas Miketz. Va'atem alu l'shalom al avichem. Go back to your father. Those words of Yosef, go back to your father peacefully. He doesn't say go back to your father. Atem alu l'shalom al avichem. Go back peacefully to your father. Meaning you could be at peace. He did it. He's a slave. I'll take care of him as my slave. Go back peacefully to your father. Of course, there's an ironic twist here. Can you go back peacefully to your father? Let's see. Can you go back peacefully to your father? Did this family change? Can you go back peacefully to your father, just like you went back peacefully to your father when you got rid of me? And here, Vayigash opens up with Yehuda going over to Yosef and says, I can't go back to my father. I will not go back to my father. Why will I not go back to my father? Because I cannot see my father in so much pain. I cannot do this again to my father. I will not do this. We will not do this. And I'll look, talk about transformation in a person. Look at the change. If you look at the next source, look at Yehuda's words when Yosef was in the pit. And Yehuda's words now, 22 years later. Vayeshev lamed zayin chavav. Vayomer Yehuda alechav, ma betza kinarig asachinu v'chisinu v'zdamai. What gain is there if we slay our brother and cover up his blood? As Rashi says, there's no money here. Let's sell him. What does he say now? Va'ata yeshev na'avdecha tachas anar eved la'adayni v'anar ya'alem echav. You need a slave. He stole. I will be your slave. Let him go back to his father. Yehuda now turns to the prime minister of Egypt and says, I shall be the slave. I'm older than him. I'm bigger than him. I'm stronger than him. I'm more powerful than him. I'm a leader by nature. As Rashi says, I'm better. I'll be better for you as a slave. I shall be a slave, maybe for life. But let him go back to his father. What just happened? What happened was the third part of tshuva. Tshuva gemura. What just happened? the entire scene was reenacted. And this time they would actually be much more innocent. They're not taking their brother and throwing him into a pit. They did not make him a slave. They were taking him home. He did something so foolish, so stupid, so criminal. Of course, they don't know that he didn't do it. They don't know the truth that it was all Yosef. This is all an experiment. This time they are innocent. They're going to go back to Yaakov and say, you know, Yaakov, I guaranteed it, but I only guaranteed him if he doesn't jump into a fire. If he jumps into a fire, what am I supposed to do? Chain him? I can't chain him. The same scene was reenacted, and the jealousy could have been reenacted too. And yet, what happened was a complete transformation. This was not like the Rambam says, I could do tshuva because I'm afraid, because I'm weak, I don't have the opportunity here. Here you're in the same situation, the same test. Your freedom will be compromised forever if you go instead of Binyamin. And yet, Yehuda said, I will not relinquish the blood of my brother, even with every ideological justification in the world. Not because he's right, he doesn't know what happened, but because this is me, he's my brother. We are brothers. I will not do this. We are a family. We're the children of Yaakov. What happens right at this moment, in this speech of Yehuda? How do we know the theme of the speech? You always look what word is repeated most. The word that's repeated most in the speech of Yehuda is my father. 14 times. 14 times he says the word Avi. And at the end he finishes, Eich elel Avi v'anar einenu iti pen ere birash yimtzes Avi. In the same pasuk, Avi twice. How can I go back without my son, without this lad? How can I go back to my father without this nar? And I will see the misfortune that will befall him. I can't. At that moment, what's the next pasuk? La yachal Yosef l'isapik. Yosef says, that's it. I can't do this anymore. I'm done. You contained yourself so beautifully till now. La yachal Yosef l'isapik. At this moment, he can't contain himself anymore. He sends everybody out. He starts sobbing again. Now his emotions come out in the public to them. Now suddenly they see how emotional and connected he was throughout. He was never disconnected from them. Even when he was disconnected from them, he was trying to see if they reconnected. His disconnection was a form of connection. It was making sure that they're connected. And when he says, Ani Yosef ha'oid avi chai, they get it. And then he says, Ani Yosef achichem asher mecharta ma'asi mitzrayma. I'm Yosef, your brother, who sold you to Egypt. Der Rechaim says, they don't know that Yosef is their brother. And they don't know they sold him to Egypt. How many Yosef brothers did they have? 100? 2, 10. So the Rechaim says, only the Rechaim, Ani Yosef achichem asher mecharta ma'asi mitzrayma. Even when you sold me, I was your brother. You may have not been my brother, but I was your brother. The Lechovich HaMagid once said, for the Rechaim to write this, he had to be in the same state of consciousness. Sometimes to write a certain interpretation, you have to be in that place. So now it becomes very clear why Yosef didn't send a message to Yaakov all these years. He could have sent a message to Yaakov. He could have sent a message to Yaakov all these years. Maybe as a slave, maybe as a prisoner, certainly as a prime minister of Egypt. What would have happened? Yaakov would celebrate, they would make a beautiful feast, the family may be reunited superficially, but the question is, were the infections really healed? Did transformation really happen? So here, in this story, we have the first story in Chumash, which is not, it's not halacha, it's a story. But all of the Hilchus Tshuva, all the laws of Tshuva, were constructed from this story. From the dynamics of this story of Yosef, the laws of Tshuva are constructed. Now look, now take a look. In your last source, you know, how our sages can articulate an entire class in 3 lines. I wish I knew how to do that. The last source, Bereishis Rabbah, Parshat Tzadik Gimel Tes. Medrash Rabbah, Parshat Vayigash, section 93. Take a look. These are the words of the Medrash. It's a little enigmatic, but after what we said, I think It's all here in these words. Amar Reb Chiya bar Abba. Reb Chiya the son of Abba said, Kol hadvarim sh'ata koire shedibre Yehuda liyosef b'fnei echav. Achat magia v'layachal Yosef lisapik. Hayabem pius liyosef, pius l'echav, pius l'binyamin. All the words that Yehuda said to Yosef until the point that he reveals himself was pius. It was a consolation. It was healing for Yosef. It was healing for all the brothers, and it was healing for Binyamin. Why? Pius liyosef. It was healing. It was appeasement. It was consolation for Yosef. Loimar. It told him, Ru'u he'echu noisen nafshay al baneha shal Rachel. Look how he's ready to give his life for the sons of Rachel. Yosef knew that he was Rachel's son and had a different relationship with his brothers because of it. It was a difficult relationship. Binyamin is also the son of Rachel. Binyamin is the next one after Yosef. Binyamin also had a special connection with his father. And the same Yehuda says, I will be a slave forever and let this boy go back to his father. What did that do to Yosef at the moment? What did it show him? Wow. The same man who was ready to sell me, the same brothers who were ready to throw me into a pit and threw me into a pit. And here's a son of Rachel, not a son of Bilhah or Leah or Zilpah. And he's ready to give his soul. Next, Pius Le'echav. There was also healing for all the brothers. Loimar, Re'u He'echu Noisen Nafshe'el Echav. See how he's giving his life for his brother. They all were upset at Yehuda. The Torah says in Vayeshev, after the story of selling Yosef, Yehuda left his brothers. Vayered, Rashi says he was demoted. The brothers dismissed him because they felt that he was the leader, he was the king. And he had the power, and he could have convinced them to bring Yosef back to their father. When they saw the pain, they realized this was terrible, and they couldn't deal with Yehuda anymore. That's why Yehuda left the family, and he went, and he found a wife, and he had a whole story, and he lost one son, and he lost another son. And he had to go through his own transformation with the story of Tamar. And that's when Yehuda saw how wrong he could have been when this woman Tamar, who he accused of harlotry and promiscuity, and really, it was his tzatka mimeni. I mean, you remember that whole story? We did it in other classes. But that whole story that Yehuda was with Tamar and he thinks that she was promiscuous. And finally, in her master stroke of genius, she makes him realize that it was all him. And suddenly, he himself is reenacting things. His own son, Eir, dies. And his son, Oinon, dies. And then the third son, Shelah, he doesn't want to marry to Tamar. And then Tamar is almost killed because of it. And suddenly he realizes who was the guilty one here. And this causes Yehuda's whole journey. But the brothers don't know who Yehuda is. But at this moment, they see, wow, it's a different Yehuda. Yehuda says, I'll just be a slave for the rest of my life. I got to take care of my brothers. And then finally, Pius LeBinyamin, there was such healing for Binyamin. Binyamin lived in the house. So he knew how they felt about Yosef. Now, he didn't know that they sold him. He wasn't there. But he may have sensed. Because of the negative relationship, what has happened, he may have sensed that there was a terrible, terrible thing that they did to Yosef. And who knows how it affected his relationship with his brothers at home. Remember, Binyamin was home all these years. He was home. And if he was home, he was with these same brothers who did this to Yosef. So how did he feel about them? Even if he did not know the details of the story. So he says, Pius LeBinyamin. Amar La Yehuda was telling him, Keshem Shenasati Nafshi Alecha, Kach ani noisen nafshi alachicha. Yehuda was telling Binyamin a message. I just gave up my whole soul for you. In the same way, I will give up today my soul for your brother. What did that mean to him? He loved Yosef. He named his 10 children all for Yosef. Binyamin had 10 children. Every name was named for Yosef, for the memory of Yosef, whom he grew up without. And now Yehuda, by saying, I will be a slave for this Binyamin, was telling him a message. I'm doing anything to save you. I will do anything and give up my life to save your brother. So the message says, V'layachal Yosef lisapik. When Yosef saw this moment, he realized transformation happened. And therefore, he could not contain himself anymore. Why is this story so important right here, right now? Because right now, the family is about to become a people. It's not a family anymore. Now it's a family. 12 boys, you have Dina, you have maybe the other daughters, you have the Einiklach, but very soon, they're about to become Am Bnei Yisrael. In Bereishis, they're not called an Am, they're called Bnei Yisrael. It's only in Shmois that Parah is the first one to call them Am, a nation. It's going to grow into a nation. And this is going to be a nation that's going to go through a lot, as we know. What is it? Hindsight is 20/20. Yosef knows that the dreams were not about him growing his ego, chas v'shalom. The dreams were about his mission. Yosef understands his mission is to make this family fertile to become God's people. How is that going to happen? And that's what Yosef is doing here. It's at this moment that the Jewish people have to realize, if we're not going to be here for each other, we're in trouble. If brothers and sisters are not going to be here for each other, we're in trouble. I mean, Jews see it today very, very vividly. When you see sophisticated people, sophisticated universities, sophisticated presidents who dedicated their life to enlightenment and higher education and intellectual academic achievement and apparently tolerance, and they can't even say that calling for the genocide of the Jewish people is like a little bit of a bad thing, chas v'shalom, to even say that. It's all about context. Somebody said, it's a pity Eichmann didn't speak with one of those presidents, and she would have told him, put up a sign in Auschwitz. It depends on the context. It depends on the context. There's a lot of pain there, but there's also a lot of power when the Jewish people know we have each other. That's very powerful. You know, sometimes a couple is going through a lot with their children, and they can't always snap their fingers and just make things go away. But the greatest blessing in those moments is when a husband and a wife have each other. Because when we have each other, it becomes a fortress. And even when curveballs are thrown and rocks are thrown and there's pain, there's a fortress that maintains confidence and love and light and redemptive clarity in difficult situations. It's like a chayma. It's like a breach. Asar B'Tevis, which this year is Friday, the Tanakh describes as a day of Samach Melech Bavel al Yerushalayim. Nebuchadnezzar laid the siege on Jerusalem. And the words he uses is Samach. Samach. He laid a siege, which of course caused a hunger. And then ultimately the city fell. It fell. Excuse me. Shivasa B'Tamos. The walls were breached. And Tisha B'Av, the Beis HaMikdash, was burnt. The word is samach. Samach literally means supported. He didn't support. It was a siege to break them. And one of the interpretations is, when he created a siege around him, nobody goes in, nobody goes out. There could be two attitudes. One attitude is, listen, all we have is each other. When we have each other, let's be here for each other. And that creates the ultimate love that eliminates the source of exile, which came from Sinas Chinah. So the samach, in a spiritual way, there was a support that was coming out in that way. That tragedy was also a tremendous support. It wasn't used that way, so the results were different. So in every situation, every family is that way. When we know we're here for each other in a very authentic way, it changes everything. I sometimes can't change the reality outside of me. So at this moment, the Jewish people who are morphing from a family into a nation must learn this. That if we're not really going to be here for each other, if I'm going to be looking of how I could throw this one into a pit and sell this one into a slave, whatever that means in a person's life, metaphorically speaking, this nation won't be able to survive. The power that we have is the love, the connection. Connection doesn't mean we agree. Yosef and Yehuda didn't agree about everything, but it means there's loyalty. It means there's trust. It means I can lean on you 1,000%. You can lean on me 1,000%. It's like in a marriage. Couples don't have to agree with each other, but they got to be here for each other. Trust each other. Know that they could lean on each other. And when they have that unity, even if there's crisis, Chalila, and even if there's difficulties, there's an unbreachable bond that just creates a different dynamic in a home. One of the worst tragedies in a home when things are difficult with children or other issues is when it creates separation in a couple. When children suffer, couples either become closer or further. They either blame each other. So she's just like you. He's just like you. If I wouldn't be married to you, my kids would have been normal. thank you for your genes. So we can go that route. And what happens? The other route is they become closer from the pain. And when they become closer, so then there's a solid edifice in the house that the children could lean on, and they feel a presence of love and leadership and connection. And that changes everything. That's also true with the Jewish people throughout history. So it's at this moment for Am Yisrael to become Am Yisrael, to become God's people. Yosef says, we all have to transform ourselves. Not just me. We all have to transform ourselves. When he sees that transformation, now he could reveal himself. Now when the family reunites, it's going to be a different type of reunification. It's not just going to be for the pictures in the magazines. It's going to be internal. And also, for them to become God's people is not an easy mission throughout history, as we all know. And we could see today, by the way, with all the craziness and all the atrocities, it allows the Jewish people to see what it means to be God's people. What exactly what it means. What does it mean that millions and millions of people who are civilized, professors and academics and politicians, can't condemn Hamas because it happened against Jews? What does that mean? What does that mean? It shows you the holiness and the goodness that the Jewish people represent. It shows you literally what it means to be God's people. The challenge now is to really internalize it, to live it. Not based on the anti-Semitism from without, but based on the conviction and idealism from within. And to be such a people, there are mistakes, there's ups and downs. And if there's no forgiveness, if there's no reconciliation, if I can't rediscover myself, reinvent myself, it's a hopeless situation. So at this moment, in the juncture of Jewish history, Yosef conducts this extraordinary experiment, showing the power of transformation, showing the power of inner work, and the ability to say, the person I was 20 years ago is not the person I am today. The person I was a year ago is not the person I was today. And maybe even the person I was yesterday is not the person I was today, in a good way. I want to take what I learned from 20 years ago. But that's the power, that's the real, real power of transformation. The pain, the crisis in this family, in that original family, it transformed them. When Yosef says, you did not do it, you did not sell me, God sent me to create refuge. It's not just physical refuge, that too. It's also spiritual refuge. If I would have remained there, everything would have looked perfect, but nothing would have been perfect. And this is a very, very profound lesson. Sometimes we see things happening in families and people's lives. Very, very painful. There's adversity. And it looks like it's all just about destruction. But as we see in this story, Yosef says, no, this was the only way transformation can happen. I needed to become a different person. Yehuda needed to become a different person. Yaakov needed to become a different person. Binyamin, every one of the brothers needed to become a different person. And they did. And Yosef demonstrated it through all of these exercises and experiments. It's a painful journey. But when I look at that pain, not from a personalized way, I'm guilty, I'm evil, I'm bad, I'm horrible, but really understanding how do I show up in this situation to be the best version of myself, that's how transformation is created. And I think in our time today, the Jewish people have been catapulted, that's the word, catapulted to a new state of consciousness. You know, there are moments in history that They shake up the tectonic plates. They shake up the foundations. And the horrific events of Simchas Torah Tov Shem Pei Dal, October 7th, 2023. Obviously, there's the atrocities, the pain, and the horrors, and the deaths, and the wounds, and those in captivity, and the soldiers in Gaza, and the whole situation, and the anti-Semitism in the world, etc. But also in a very, very deep spiritual place, the Jewish people have been catapulted into a very, very profound space. And at such a moment, one ought not to forfeit the voices, the Kol Dama Medaka, the powerful message in history that warrants and calls for a different level of transformation. I'm not talking only on an external level, I'm talking much more in a very internal space. A transformation that happens when a person finally can embrace the truest and deepest part of their soul. When a person can finally embrace the truest and deepest part of their holiness and their divinity. When every one of us truly becomes Yisrael Asher Becha Espar, the truest person, the most authentic, powerful, creative version of yourself, where you become, I become, we become channels for absolute clarity and resolve and love and light and hope and healing and connection and authenticity. Because one of the worst things a person could do is ignore or forfeit opportunities that are so powerful. Yosef told his brothers, did we lose this opportunity or did we learn from it? He saw that they did not lose the opportunity. And that's why the family could be reconciled. And in our generation too, as we were catapulted into such a powerful space, nobody asked for it, nobody expected it, nobody wanted it, and certainly nobody understands it fully, because there are things beyond anybody's comprehension, as we spoke quite a few times. But the real question is, can I, can you, can we show up in this situation with our hearts opened, our souls opened, greater than ever? Have a wonderful and beautiful week. Ezer Hashem will have a class next week as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Should be a good to better for the family and the whole class. His style. Thank you. Thank you for the tea. I think if he would have been reunited with his father, it would have been nice, but ultimately it would have stunted the growth. If the family didn't change, so his family would come visit, he would bring the family, they would be, his father didn't know that they sold him. So there would be supposed unity. But the inner work that had to happen wouldn't have happened. Yeah. Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming. Yeah. So obviously the tshuva, obviously there was something missing. I mean, it does say here that there was healing for Yosef, healing for the brothers, and healing for Binyamin. In terms of Asara Rege Malchus, I guess you have to say that there was still something, a blemish that remained from what they did to him.
I have a question. No, sorry, I always have a question. I'll be quick. How do I conduct myself at work in the hospital? Nobody wants to hear about Eretz Yisrael. No one wants to hear. It's like I'm the big elephant in the room. They don't mind hearing about my babies, this and that. They absolutely don't want me to talk about Eretz Yisrael politics.
What's your position in the hospital?
Really, I'm one of the workers. I'm respiratory therapist.
Uh-huh.
I sit in the office with the others.
Right.
Sometimes we have too much time to talk.
Maybe ask them about it. Say, imagine, maybe ask them very cordially. Say, you know, imagine your family, like, you know, went through a tremendous massacre. You know, maybe back in your hometown where you came from. Would you feel the need to talk about it and express yourself? Say, this is my family. Maybe.
I have strong feelings, you know. Strong feelings. I understood what the Pope did. Many of them are Catholics. Again, there is always Catholics. I'm afraid that it might be used towards them. Well, what can we expect from you?
Well, a lot of Christians are very supportive of Israel today, but they're not. They're not.
It's just that they say, I don't want to know.
I don't know the nature of the relationship between you and them. So if it's that friendly, so then maybe just like bring that up. Say, you know, I want to share something with you. They may say, we didn't realize. They may say something else. I don't know. But that itself will clarify things for you.
Yes, who they are.
Yeah, and then you'll see, you know.
Where do they really feel?
Exactly. That will clarify it. But don't do it with anger. Because you have to see them every day in the hospital. So I would just do it with grace and court. You'll see who they are.
This class is brought to you by the yeshiva.net. Please help us continue the classes. Make even a small contribution at www.theyeshiva.net/donate.